Welcome, everyone, to the Space Game Junkie Podcast. I, as always, am your co-host, Brian, and joining me, as always, is your co-host, Jim.
Deeds, not words.
It's good to have you back this week, Jim. That was kind of strange.
Yeah. What movie is that a quote from? Deeds, not words.
Galaxy Quest. Galaxy Quest. No. Is it?
Nope.
I don't know.
I know, but I say I quote it all the time.
It's a classic 1982 spectacle, or 81.
Yeah.
It's Megaforce.
Yes. Oh, God.
That's why I know it, because it was written on the back of the comic book ad.
Yeah. I think the script was written on the back of the comic book ad.
There was an ad on the back of comics, right? Oh,
I watched that movie recently, actually. It doesn't hold up.
Yes, it does.
No, it doesn't. You don't hold up. We watched it at 1.5 speed because it was so painful.
Oh, my God.
It was so bad it was supposed to launch a million toys, of which I think it launched two.
I actually looked for toys back when I was a kid and found nothing. I had so devastated.
I had the Matchbox cars for it, though. Yeah. But what was that, like a big wheel, right? The Fisher-Price big wheel?
No, they had a
big wheel that was a Megaforce big wheel, and it launched frickin' rockets off the
handle. What?
Hell yeah.
Like the motorcycle that launched the rocket? Oh, yep. How did I miss that?
I don't know.
Five or six kids in Idaho were killed by the explosive warheads.
They threw the bowling balls at the...
So, folks, yeah, we welcome to our Megaforce episode. That's all we're going to talk about this week.
There was a video game, too, for the 2600.
I know. I own that. I did. I had it.
Feel for it.
Yeah, it was almost as bad as the ET game, but not quite. So we have some guests this week because we have a very interesting topic. First, the CEO at Kerberos Product. Kerberos. I told you.
You nailed it. It's Kerberos. You got it.
I know. No. I had to correct myself. Kerberos Productions. Martin Cirillis.
Very good.
Did I do it? I did it already?
Yep, you got it. You nailed it.
Yay! I'm terrible with names, seriously. also, the COO at Kerberos, Chris Stewart.
Howdy, guys.
And finally, friend of the show, having him back after, God, 80 fucking other episodes, 80 episodes since, or 90, I think, since we had you last on, is Paul Tobia.
Which Paul number is he? Is he Paul 3?
No, I think he's number one.
I should be one of the first.
I think you're one. I think Paul is maybe our first Paul.
Oh, he's the OP. Or no, the original Paul.
What about I don't think he was. No, that was Mike. That was Mike.
Did the original Paul know Jesus? Like,
yes. The original Paul knew Jesus. The second Paul died and was replaced by fake Paul.
That's right.
And then there's Paul Tobia, who was number one in our hearts.
So. Then there's Pope John Paul Ringo.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. By the way, I get the fake Paul reference. I'm down with that conspiracy theory.
So it's because of Paul, and I have to send a special thanks to you, Paul, that we can do this show because Paul put me in touch with Chris Stewart, almost 2 years ago now.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
But it was about early 2013-ish, and because we talked to Paul, Homeworld Cataclysm came up. I had not played it at the time. And I was like, what the heck's going on with Cataclysm? They were already talking about refurbishing Homeworld even back then. And there was no mention of Cataclysm. So Paul put me in touch with Chris. And there was an article that came out shortly thereafter where I quoted Chris about it, which has been getting a lot of traction, which made me want to do this show because a lot of people are interested. It's kind of like Waldo, where... Or Carmen Sandiego, where in the world is Homeworld Cataclysm? So let's kind of start from the beginning on how this all came to pass. Now, Martin, you worked on the original Homeworld, is that correct?
Yes, I did.
Tell us about that.
Well, wait. Before you do that, let's go back. Way back to the dawn of time. Back.
Here it comes.
Yeah, so back when words were written on paper. And
what's the deal with Homeworld?
Yeah, totally. See, I didn't have to do it. He did it himself, so there it is.
Because I'm an old ham.
Jim, you've been chomping at the bit to say this.
Oh, so my God. Yeah. Well, because, man, it's like, you know, we're bros from back in the day, the 90s, when journalism was written, not videoed. So,
people actually got paid to do it, like it was a job that required.
I know, and you got paid. What?
Yep.
Wow. So... So anyway, so you wrote for Computer Gaming World.
Yep.
You were like the show closer there, because I remember you always had the last word at the back.
Yeah,
right?
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, what else did you do for them?
Reviewer. That's how I kind of came in. Actually, do you remember a game from Microsoft called Mantis Space Fighter or something?
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Yeah. That game was so bad.
It was terrible.
That I wrote a letter to Computer Game World to complain about it, and I got a job out of it.
That must have been the most epic rant.
Their editor wrote back basically going, well, you know what? If you could do this again on some other game, let me know.
That's not the one that wiped your drive, though, was it?
No, that was after I was... That was an
Myth
Interplay.
Soul Blighter? Myth 2?
Yeah, and it was some Interplay game of some kind.
What? Wait, what happened?
Well, they said it was a preview copy. They send the late beta, you know, late alpha, early beta. I play it a bit. It kind of malfunctions, so I uninstall it, and it wiped my hard drive.
Oh, wow. Because I remember there was Warzone 2100 shipped with a virus, and then I think it was Myth 2, because I remember Penny Arcade did a cartoon about it, and it would install in your C drive, and then whenever you uninstalled it, it just did an RM-R. Pow, and just blew the whole drive away. So, yeah, that's cool. So after CGW, like, when did you leave them?
I left them in the kind of the glory days of the internet boom. I went to one of the editors from there, went to CNET. So I and Aaron Dembo went over from Computer Game World over to CNET. And we did a lot of review work there. And this is important because, one of our editors from there then went to work with Sierra, on game development as like a producer PR guy.
Oh.
And then late, I guess in 99, it would be from 98, I get a phone call from him, which I think is just him catching up. And he's like, I know you have done some script doctoring in the past, like for Hollywood stuff. And I'm like, yes. And he's like, would you like to do it on a game? I thought, possibly. he's like, have you heard of that spaceship game they're making in Vancouver? And I'm like, yes, I do. Just did a preview of it, actually, a couple months ago. And that was kind of how it all started. They brought me in late to do some script campaign doctoring because Sierra had some issues. And, yeah. And so I did some very intensive, very rewarding work with the gang down there at Relic and basically rewrote the script, kind of rearranged some bits in single player. This is all very late stage. This is like post beta just about.
Oh, okay. So did they have like a bunch of the voice work already committed and then you came in and rewrote it and they had to re-record or what?
Bits of narrative already recorded, and that stuff I didn't touch. The main issue was that, and the campaign was done, right? So the most I could do was kind of like Minecraft it, right? Like take huge blocks of what had been done and kind of move it around a little bit, because I'd be like, there should be a whole mission where you get to deliver pie to the pie master. It's like, no, there's 8 minutes before this goes out the door. So it was very much just, hello, here's the mission where you discover the space relic. And I'm just like, and they're like, make the space relic mean something. It's like, okay, I can do that. So really, I was, the only thing I actually added to that game was the Return to Carrick mission. That's the only thing I could do. Because I thought it was dramatically important for that planet to die on screen. Whereas originally it was just in a communication bubble.
I have an admission. I liked the story of Homeworld, but the gameplay was kind of dull.
Yeah. There was, like I said, they were pushing their engine, and it was advanced for its time and stuff. And
Yeah. There's stuff that in the first Homeworld, like the maneuvering your ships in a 3D space on a 2D monitor, that still hasn't been properly solved in games today. So.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah.
They were working hard, pioneering some stuff there, definitely.
Now, I have a question about your writing work on that, Martin. Who's Marcus Schuyler?
That was my nom de plume at the time.
Because I found that I looked up your name and that came up on IMDb. I was like, what?
Oh, there's an even better one with what, Montgomery Crabapple, which was
what?
Alex Garden rewriting my nom de plume for Shits and Giggles.
And it got committed in the final print.
It got committed in the final print of the so Manual of the Year went to Montgomery Crabapple, which was desperately amusing.
That was a great manual.
That was fun to write, actually. I wrote that with the help of Aaron Dembo. We teamed up and did a lot of the background work. Because basically they had spaceships, right? And Sierra's like, we'd like something for the clan guild scene of gaming to latch onto. So could you make us some factions? It's like, we could do that. So, all that cool guild factioning things, the different sub-aspects of that culture, which I think they threw out for Homeworld 2. That was all done at the request of Sierra.
Now, let's kind of move on to Cataclysm. It's not a sequel. Were there a lot of expandalones back in the day? I don't recall there being a lot of...
It came up from time to time because Sierra, God bless their old hearts, were never particularly daring. So for them to want to do it, it had to have been done in the past. What you're looking at there is reactionary thinking, right? So Homeworld's released to a lot of critical acclaim.
Right.
Sierra goes, right, we need expansion. And then it starts to sell a lot, to which they go, Christ, we need a sequel, like as quick as possible. And then they go, oh, sales are leveling off. Maybe not, right?
Oh, God.
Yeah. And then Relic also starts going, well, if there's going to be a sequel, we're bloody going to make it. And you already, the contract for the expansion is already to these other little guys, Barking Dog. So it got kind of kicked around that way. Is that not right, Mr. Stewart?
That's about exactly right. The compromise then was to release it on its own and call it the standalone expansion, which almost instantly confused everybody.
Now, I'm going to admit at the time, I don't know if you guys know this, but I never really finished Homeworld because I got bored. So I never played Cataclysm until a couple of weeks ago for the first time. And I'm digging it. Go ahead.
Cool. No, I was going to say, Cataclysm, I enjoyed working on Cataclysm because basically I got to futz with stuff much closer to the beginning, right? So I had the mission structure was kind of set and the basic idea, but Barking Dog approached me much earlier in the process. And so I was able to do more coherent story stuff.
Right. Now, there are a lot of enhancements to the original game in Cataclysm. Let's kind of break some of those down. Like, there's time acceleration, the ships can be upgraded, that sort of thing. So run some of those down for me and where they came from.
Actually, I guess Chris Stewart's better for that because that a lot of those were very, very early on in the project before I joined it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I recall later on you came up with a couple of things like the mimic ship or the super fighter and all that.
No, the mimic was already there.
Was it already there?
Yeah.
But you were the super
missiles,
fighter.
The missiles off the fighters was my... Actually, I paid a program to do that out of my own pocket.
You know, I was trying to figure that one out last night, right? Because I'd researched the missiles, and I'm like, well, wait, I need a destroyer or something to shoot these things. Why did I do this? And then I discovered, oh yeah, I can launch them off the fighters. But it wasn't like abundantly clear I could do it until I went.
That's what those little arms are for.
Well,
that's why those fighters have those little arms.
What you saw was when everything settled down with Sierra and Relic and all that about how Cataclysm was going to be treated. It basically meant that the code base was allowed to trunk off on its own. And that really solidified in a lot, because there was a period of time there where when stuff was going in, Relic wanted to see it to see if they wanted to propagate it back, etc., or at least keep it in mind for moving forward. But basically, once everything settled down to, well, Cataclysm's going to be its own thing, well, awesome. We no longer have to worry about they've just done an update to the you know, the last update to the Homeworld code base now has to be propagated over into Cataclysm. It's going to take 2 weeks to jam it all in and all that. And it really freed up a lot of room then to just add in what Cataclysm, you know, what we wanted to see in Cataclysm.
So how close is the code of Cataclysm to the original Homeworld? Did you guys fork it off and leave it fairly close, or
we probably got two iterations away, maybe from the last of the Homeworld builds, Martin? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, it was one or two, but then the stuff we were doing was fairly divergent, right? Like
exactly.
And all that.
Well, this is what I mean. Like the base Homeworld we left off at was a couple of the last big build updates for Homeworld, and then yes, like Martin said, and as I pointed out, that's where the team went off and started building in Cataclysm specific stuff. I don't even know if I could put a percentage on it. I mean, that was I didn't even work on the code directly, so it's hard for me to say.
Well, the reason I bring that up is because the Gearbox guys, when they were asked, you know, like really early on in the whole HD reboot thing they're doing with Homeworld, they're like, well, are you guys going to do Cataclysm? And they said, well, no, because apparently the dog ate the source code or something, and you know, so we can't do that. So I was just wondering, like, is it mostly mission stuff that they would have had to reproduce? Or
I don't mean to step on anybody's toes, but I think that's a really dubious argument.
That's kind of what it sounded like, yes.
Like, to be fair, they're already using massively new engine technology anyways, right? They just have to be, right?
Yeah. There's very little of a 15-year-old engine you can pull up and run with.
Well, would they have had to come to you guys to get permission or pay for something?
No. We didn't own any of that. That was Barking Dog. Those were our bosses. We were just employees.
And Barking Dog didn't even own it either. It was a subcontract with Relic and, by extension, Sierra, who owned the IP. So it was
packaged in the deal when they bought it anyway. They just didn't do it.
Yeah. Yeah, packaged or implied. Like we're not familiar with the legal wording or anything like that, but it is Homeworld Cataclysm. And right. there's nothing legally in the creation of it.
Smelling DLC here.
Yeah, that separates it from the Homeworld IP. I think what it is though is it just never got regarded when they were doing the selling of it. So it's kind of implied there, it was just never specifically worded when anybody dealt with it. So
yeah, like recreating that game in a new engine that's already serving for Homeworld is, like I said, just requires some people who remember exactly what the game did, and that's it.
Well, there's a large amount of stuff that would have to be done, and is already being done for Homeworld, right? So the Cambits has to come up back and HD his cinematics. Paul Ruskay still has all the original source, so he'll just, you know, he would just render out the sound and the music at a higher, you know, it doesn't have to be crammed on a CD anymore, so we can do, you know, full spectrum audio and all that. And then, recreating the missions and all that to fit the new, the remastered engine that they've built. So, and then the last little, you know, icing on the cake would be the little things that were Cataclysm specific, but from some of the stuff I've seen in Homeworld, it's kind of already laying Homeworld and Homeworld 2 specifically, because Homeworld 2 picked up a couple of things.
Can I call Dave right now and tell him that we need docking done?
You need docking done? Yes. You want to hear it? Well,
our lead programmer here at Kerberos nearly lost an eye to Cataclysm.
What? Okay, wait. Stop. Hold. Tell me that. What happened there?
There was, you've played Cataclysm.
A little bit.
The little bit where the resourcers clamp onto stuff, right?
Yeah.
They put out their little pods, which is super groovy and kind of sexy.
I do kind of love that, yeah.
Yeah, and the little bit where they have to swoop up and over to get into the garbage bucket hangar bay.
Yeah.
Instead of straight in like Homeworld. That drove a very dear friend of ours nearly to the brink of madness. And if you can imagine, how many times you have to stick your knuckle in your eye working to develop a debilitating, destructive, degenerative eye disease.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
In just one eye. Because literally that man suffered like no other program I'd ever seen. Every 2 weeks, he'd be like, okay, docking, it's done. And then someone would like change a period 4,000 lines away in the code and it would break.
Oh, no.
Yeah. just all sorts of stuff. And sometimes I felt bad because a couple times I'd be the blame for it because, like, for instance, a lot of stuff in Homeworld worked really beautifully based exactly on exact numbers. And because I cannot resist dicking with stuff, I'm like, oh, look, fighters have different speeds. Maybe different fighters should have different speeds, like in real life. So I would go in and futz around with stuff, and things would start crashing into the side of the hangar bay and stuff like that. So Dave would shriek.
He's still alive and can still see, though. So
yes, you know. But he can't listen to his interview. Otherwise, his eye will actually pop out of his head.
Yeah, I've had a few games where I thought I was going to stab myself in the eye, but I've never actually carried through with it like that. So
there were some aspects of that original code base that were challenging. Believe it or not.
Yeah, it was a real charisma based build on Homeworld there, and there was a lot of fast and furious. I mean, it's never easy building your own engine, and that's like, I mean, back then you had to build your own engine. It's not,
and it was where no one had gone before.
Like, so you couldn't. There was no options to just pick up somebody else's engine, and even if you did, you'd have to change it heavily anyways. And yeah, getting the Homeworld to be the Homeworld that you guys are familiar with, and you know, by extension, Cataclysm to be the Cataclysm you guys are familiar with. Yeah, there was a lot of from scratch and a lot of black boxing. You know. Pulling on one piece of string for the Homeworld code and then trying to figure out what the heck happened at the other end. And so, yeah, the programmers, not only Dave, but I recall a couple of Relic programmers kind of had their small little time to go live in a van down by the river moments. So,
and there's multiple ways of docking in this game. So I can kind of see how it'd be crazy. Cause you have the front of this mothership where the little workers dock. And then you have the hangar module where lots of other things dock. Yeah. And then you have this. I love the processors. I don't know why. I dig the processor ships. And the little workers can dock there too.
Yeah. No, it's when I sometimes lecture classes on, like local classes on game design and stuff like that. And that's always my cautionary tale. Because docking, the word docking is one word. Everybody understands it. And if you were describing somebody, you'd go, and these little ships, they'll dock with some stuff. And everybody in the room will go, uh-huh, that sounds right. And then you'll move on. Right? And then some poor programmer will lose his life, right?
Oh, no.
Well, the first laws of design on big project is little words can carry serious repercussions.
Yeah. You're very kind. You're very kind there, Martin, because there's always that first step with the programmers, too, where they show up and, like, docking's working, and you're like, you get it within 100 meters, and then it teleports onto the side. Yes, it's docked. Okay, technically it's docked, but it doesn't look very pretty. Can we go back to this? And then 3 weeks later, you know, there's, you know, unwise self-done haircuts and, you know, losing eyes. And
well, it's just a challenging design for that ship. I mean, the old Homeworld mothership, right, the big half-moon thing. That's one thing, right? This, you know, there's so many different doors that go in and out of the ship. And then is each ship like a special case, like it only uses one door, or do they use whatever is available?
Nope. Let's just say if me now finds a time machine where I can go back and leave messages in the past, it'll be to go in and go, turn the docking bucket upside down, please. Please let the ships enter from below the mothership and go into that vast opening.
Yeah, and I never did notice until you said, but now I can't not see it as a dumpster. It's just
it really is. Yeah, it really is.
It's like that old show Quark back when they.
Yep.
You remember that?
The modular mothership was a big cool idea, right? Like, speaking of breaking new ground, that was it, right? Like, to have a ship that was skeleton to start with and then add these big section onto it was super cool.
Yeah.
So that hangar module out there was just, you know, it was a big poly piece of cool at the time.
Yeah. Well, have you guys seen speaking of modular stuff, how many games that are currently in the cooker that are Homeworld influenced? I mean, even before Gearbox said, you know, hey, yeah, we're going to do this. Yeah. Right, because there's, help me out here, Brian. What all is there? So there's Shallow Space, that's kind of Homeworldy. And then that one that Stephanie Rancourt's working on, Deep Space Settlement.
Deep Space Settlement.
Now that's the one that it made me think of, because those ships are super modular. I mean, they're actually built like Lego bricks, and they snap them together and make different ships. So that's
for
pretty
me. The homeworld nod sign is the engine trail, right? Like, there should just be an app built into Google search engine trails, and it'll return which homeworld clone game is under production at any given
time. Yeah.
Just by scanning screenshots, right? Because that was such a classic homeworld thing.
Yeah,
classic homeworld, and an elegant solution to a major problem in space RTS is, when I'm zoomed out, how do I see the little ships? It's like, oh, there's the lines. Perfect.
Yeah, and how do I get a vector on their movement?
Exactly.
And especially at the resolution that you guys were operating at, which today, was it meant to top out at like 1024 by 768? Because if I take the resolution higher than that, the 3D works fine, but then the 2D menus and stuff get really choppy. Like, I can hardly use the mouse.
I can't imagine. Yeah, I can't imagine anyone having resolution higher than 1024 back then. Right? Like,
yeah.
Remember, monitors were like fueled by firewood back then.
Oh yeah, I had a kerosene computer myself, but it was.
They weighed 80 pounds.
Yeah, but it still goes up to like 1600 by something, right? And it don't dare do it. But yeah, I play it in software mode. I can.
At the time, it was the average person was peeping at their monitors at 800 by 600, and then the bleeding edge, which gaming always wants to kind of be there for those guys with their gaming rigs that could do it, 1024 by 768 would make sense. But yeah, if you push it up beyond that and the HUD and all that starts acting wonky, that's you've pushed past what was the design resolution limit of the game.
Yeah.
Remember, we're talking about a period of time when publishers insisted on a no 3D card version. Right?
Yeah. Well, honestly, in software mode, that I find in a lot of the older games, like TIE Fighter is one of them, where if you put it in 3D, it actually kind of gets blurry, right? And now that we have machines that can render that stuff in straight software mode, it's actually highly detailed versus letting the 3D card mangle it. So the textures are way better.
Yeah, because your motherboard and your main chipset are about a trillion times more powerful than the best graphic cards back then, right? I mean, at the time, I think one of our programmers had a twin Voodoo, right? And that was like, oh,
he was there.
Yes, he was actually. I remember the day he bought it because I think the price tag was what, 10 grand, Martin, or something like that. Like, it was,
no, that was for the projector.
Oh, for the projector. I'm talking. Who am I thinking of then? Who had the machine? It was a monster.
Yeah.
It was his own custom build off the shelf thing, and it was
sterilized 3 artists before they moved away from
whatever it was. But it was the day waster where everybody had to go over and see the game in this super pretty.
Oh, yeah, I remember. SLI, Voodoo SLI. Oh.
Yep. Cooking steaks on the back of your computer, those are the days.
Massive cards.
Right. You know, we should make an agreement where we stop every 10 minutes or so and let Paul come in and say something, reveal some secret about visiting us or something like that, just so he's not left out.
Tell us the dark secrets, Paul.
Yeah, Paul, tell us the secret.
Paul can't talk until he shrills, "What about Treasure Planet?" in a fanboyish voice.
We got
Treasure Planet the last time he was on here.
We're actually going to talk about that.
Yeah. Because that's what started our relationship with Paul, is he was like the only person on Earth who had played Treasure Planet.
Still is, actually.
And he wrote about it.
That's why Paul will forever be number one to us.
That's right.
Oh, we're going to talk about Treasure Planet after a little bit of after some more Cataclysm. Don't you worry.
Yeah, how come that's not on? Well, okay, I'll wait. But
I actually have it queued up, guys. I actually have it queued up.
There we go.
All right, back to Cataclysm then.
Back to Cataclysm. So yeah, they wanted a sequel, then they wanted an expansion, then they wanted a sequel, then they weren't sure what the hell to do with it. So did that hurt the marketing of the game?
Yeah, I think so, right? I mean, it was always no one knew quite what to do with it, right?
The main thing was the confusion with the marketplace, because Sierra never shirked its responsibilities in marketing its stuff. I don't know. I think Homeworld probably, had a bigger push than Cataclysm did.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like it was, you know, half-assed or anything like that. But the main problem was, is when you put it out, people just kind of assumed that because it was Homeworld such and such that this was the expansion to it. But people were then confused about whether they needed Homeworld to play it, which they didn't. And then other people were like, well, I haven't played the first one yet, so I'll wait on the second one. And
They caught on pretty quick. I mean, I think as far as people's perception, we would have been way better off if anime had been more popular back then. So if you had marketed it as Homeworld, side story, people would have gotten it, right?
Yeah.
As it was, you know, as it was, we had to market this game as a Homeworld adventure and then be pressured heavily not to say anything that it was going to have any effect on the Homeworld universe whatsoever, right? Or that we were doing anything sequely. So, I mean, often we'd be presenting at E3, and what do you say, right? Come, play our cool new game. But it has nothing to do with anything. That's not the best marketing slogan.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah.
I mean, I know at the time, since I was lukewarm on Homeworld, I was like, why would I want more of that? I didn't get it. I didn't understand. You know, I didn't understand at all.
Yeah, hey.
So the U.S. Air Force, liked our interface, though, so that was good.
Yeah,
I got to say, I like your interface, too.
There I am.
Okay. There we go.
Sorry.
Yeah, literally, we were showing the game off at E3, and an Air Force colonel slid in and, like, started scribbling notes. Right?
I still have a DOD, somebody's DOD business card somewhere.
Yep.
I should take that up sometime, see if it still works there.
Because, lo and behold, what was the Air Force probably interested in at the time? Controlling diverse abstract units?
Yeah.
It's like Homeworld 3 drone strike.
Yeah, because the clue was he wasn't interested in the game with the spaceships. He was interested in Sensor Manager, right?
Which is awesome. I do love Sensor Manager.
Exactly, right? Like, that was his field of interest, because he was just like, oh, look, you can see what's going on, and you can tell your diverse units with very simple symbols, and you can order them to attack. And the rest of us are like, please don't kill us.
Now I gotta ask. I don't know. I don't remember if this is in the original Homeworld or not. So correct me if I'm wrong. But the drag box to attack command, was that in the original Homeworld, or did you guys add that? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, I know exactly what you're talking about.
No, I think it was not in the original, because I remember being pissed off playing the original, trying to pixel hunt on and click accurately on those little dots. So.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you either way for sure, because I did so much playtesting on Cataclysm that it's just burnt. It's burnt into my memory, right? So I couldn't say when that entered. But it was certainly damn useful in multiplayer, that's for sure.
It's just useful. I think every RTS should have it. I don't know of many other RTSs.
Yeah, Bandbox and then...
Area attack is becoming a thing, and in a lot of modern RTSs are getting the handle of that. But this is, you know, we're talking 10, 15 years ago. So
exactly. And I was playing it, and when the tutorial told me I could do that, I was like,
Bandbox with click exclusion is amazingly powerful, right? Like, it's just
the what
bandbox everything, deselect what you don't want, right?
Do you do that? Wait, what?
I don't know if we had it in Cataclysm, but I've seen it in other games, and we had it in Treasure Planet. Because the trick was, you would bandbox everything.
Right.
You would get the listing of what's in the bandbox, right? Like 4 spice rings, 3 pretzel sticks, and 2, whatever the rest of that
French hens commercial.
That's right. And then you would go, okay, cool, deselect the French hens, right? Right, on the sidebar, and then click, and off they go. Yeah.
Now, if you select one of them, you just select them.
You just select those, yeah. There's no deselect, right? But that was the start of that idea, right?
That is a good idea.
Yeah. I'm amazed that it just isn't the de facto everything, right? But yeah.
So yeah, the band box select thing is that's a feature that those guys that made Sins of a Solar Empire ripped off from you guys, right?
Sure. I don't know. That was. Do you see that? I made my diplomacy roll.
That was a very good diplomacy roll.
I only have 22% in diplomacy.
The Ironclad, the founders, the two of the founders were junior programmers at Barking Dog.
No, one was senior. One was junior.
One was. Oh, okay.
No, Jamie was brilliant, and
that's okay. Sure. That's true. They're all young to me, though, so I just get those things confused sometimes. So yeah, they were there in the mix. So yeah.
Okay, see, I thought you guys were actually directly involved in the Sins stuff.
Nope.
Oh no.
Oh okay. That hence my humor there. I thought it was you, but never mind.
Moving on.
No, and they did their Sins, and we did our Sots. So
yeah, that's right. Yes, we did Sword of the Stars. Which was a real 4X. Oh, I blew my diplomacy roll.
You blew your diplomacy roll.
Oh, shit.
But not a crit failure.
What you meant to say is a pure RTS. That's right. Opposed to their hybrid RTS.
Yeah, no, I think mine had the word BS somewhere in it, but that's... Yeah.
So after the game came out, because I don't want any more diplomacy roll fails right now. The game came out,
You've got to see what happens when Martin rolls a one on a diplomacy roll.
No. Oh, shit. Oh, God. Yep. You're attacked by stupid AI.
Quick, ask another question. Quick.
But, so the game sold, and then you guys got bought by Rockstar. I mean, Barking Dog, excuse me. Got bought by Rockstar?
That's correct.
After Treasure Planet.
After Treasure Planet, yeah.
After Treasure Planet. And then no one really knows what happened to the source code after that. Is that what I've been reading?
Yeah. Did they buy you because you were suddenly a hot property after Treasure Planet? Or
nope.
Yes, after Treasure Planet, we had to beat them off with a stick.
Actually, Treasure Planet does figure into it because what they did do was they were doing a shooter with... they were thinking about doing a shooter with Barking Dog. And then they were also interested in the potential for GTA for online use, like massive multiplayer way back then. So, the space team that had just come off Treasure Planet then did a feasibility study for, Grand Theft Auto Online. And our recommendation was at the time and the current technology, it was a bad idea. And because we already had a reputation from Disney on the corporate side of things that we worked very well with other people's stuff, and we demonstrated that on this GTA Online project, then that interests them in a great deal in buying us.
Okay. Yeah. But it sounds like that's kind of where the story for Cataclysm seems to end at the moment, is that it seems like it got lost somewhere at Rockstar.
Most likely.
To be candid, I don't think Rockstar cared either way.
No, because I don't recall that we weren't sending code archives back to the Rockstar offices. We probably would have had them with Sierra, but then of course Sierra went under. And then,
do you want a quick, fast Rockstar story? This is my favorite Rockstar story.
Okay, go ahead.
And it also explains the origins of Kerberos Productions and the team movement. So we were just finishing off. We actually did that proposal for GTA Online recommendation, and then we did Treasure Planet, and then Rockstar bought Barking Dog kind of towards the end of the Treasure Planet project. So it was that weird kind of, you finish working for someone else and then we own you, right? But because they had liked us through our team through the GTA Online thing, they were like, the line was, okay, boys, we're being bought by Rockstar, which is awesome. Everybody would get a bit of a cut, so yay. And the Rockstar really loves your team, right? So... Martin, and at the time it was Giori, was the producer, right? They're going to sit you two guys down, and you guys are going to meet with the Grand Poobah at Rockstar, and you guys are going to sit there for a week in New York and work out the perfect project for your team. And I'm just like, holy crap, that is awesome. Because, you know, these guys were flush with GTA money, right? They're richer than God. They don't have to treat us that decently. So it's like, right. That's awesome. So we get back to work on finishing Treasure Planet. Da, 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 da. 2 weeks later, we get called in. Okay, they're a bit busy, but they're going to fly in, and you're going to spend the weekend working on a project. Well, hey, that's mighty cool of them. That's awesome. 2 weeks after that. Okay, very busy. They'll be there for an afternoon only. You'll have a couple hours to meet with them. Okay, well, still, we can talk. That's good. Okay, they can't come to Vancouver. They'll call, though. Oh, okay, right? After that. Okay, here's what you're doing. That was it.
Without consulting you, we've decided the perfect game for you is...
Bully.
Bully.
Yeah.
You realize you're like PC strat games, right? Yes.
Yep.
So... But yeah, when Rockstar absorbed Barking Dog, all the drives and all that would have been with the, you know, in the IT room there. Their offices moved around a couple of times after we formed Kerberos, and then yeah, it closed up. Whatever it was there a year or so.
I'm sure you'd have a tough time finding the Treasure Planet code base too, right? I mean, just that little anecdote was that they had very little interest in what we had done before.
Yep.
That's a damn shame, because there is quite a bit of interest in reviving Cataclysm, but it doesn't sound like
if they want to have
it. Well, like we said, go ahead, Martin.
Yeah,
you and I are about to make the same answer.
So I was about to say, do I have perfectly frank license here, Mr. Stewart?
Say whatever you want.
Sure, go for it.
Yeah, you're not my producer though, so he's my producer.
Sorry, I thought you meant on the show. Sorry.
That's true. To be perfectly honest, if someone wants Cataclysm, then start asking those guys to drag us in and help make it, right? Literally would take very little time to recreate Cataclysm with a new engine base, as long as you know exactly what that game did. You know, and I don't think any of us guys who were on the team have forgotten any of it.
Especially the docking.
Yeah, exactly, right? You have to buy him an embossed eye patch now. Way to go. But yeah, literally, you want Cataclysm, start bugging people to, you know, bring us in to consult. And literally with a couple old programmers and a couple guys who have done this new engine, which looks pretty cool, you can have Cataclysm. Easy peasy.
And that's what they did with Homeworld, right? I mean, yeah, exactly. They've got some Relic guys there working, right?
Yeah.
It's not just Gearbox.
Yeah, the source code thing is a red herring, right? It is, right?
So then what do you think it is? Like, what do you think the reason is? Wow, look at what's going on.
They want to see how it does. Every publisher right now is very cash cautious. They love you guys. They love the IP. The problem is it was a gamble, right? It's been however many X years, and they want to make sure that it's going to perform.
Right, because there's how many people that say, oh, God, we love Homeworld, you know, whatever, right? Yeah. They're very vocal. But whenever it becomes... You know, it's like, okay, so you got 5,000 guaranteed sales. 5,000 sales does not pay off the investment. So you need, like, you know, hundreds
of thousands. You're going to have to expand the base, right?
So. So it's like, if it does that, I could definitely see those guys saying, okay, now we need the DLC.
Yeah.
And here it comes, right?
They've got our number if they need it, right? The point is, and also you kind of said it yourself, right? I was kind of okay on Homeworld and not that interested in Cataclysm. That sentence resonates through the food chain, right?
So I apologize. Okay.
Well, it was just ignorance. Like, we didn't know what the hell it was other than, this is like some third-party cat, you know, some third-party Homeworld thing. What is this?
Yeah. And the sentence still stands, though, right? Homeworld, yay! Cataclysm, right? Like, you know, it doesn't leap to mind.
Right. You should have called it Homeworld More of That.
Yeah, exactly, right.
Homeworld More Awesome. Basically. Yeah, right. Oh my God, the AI is just totally teaming up against me. It's hilarious.
Well, there was a couple of reviews at the time that referred to Cataclysm, confusingly, as 1.5. So.
Oh no.
Yeah.
But there's stuff that you guys did in Cataclysm that wasn't done in Homeworld and wasn't done in Homeworld 2. I mean, just looking at how the story ties in with the mothership, right? You guys start out with they're not the badasses of the world, right? They're the folks who were asleep, and they were miners, and you start out with a big mining ship, and then half of it breaks off and turns into zombies in space.
Spoilers!
Super awesome.
I haven't played it yet. Spoilers.
But you see,
there is one part, you know, the story narrative fiction background of, you know, Martin and Aaron. And it's also one part that Sierra and, more to the point, Relic wanted it made clear that Cataclysm was not
was a side story,
which is why we had to make it very clear these people are doing their own little story and they're not impacting the rest, you know. And what and part of that was they were looking forward to two and they didn't want us to do anything that they were then have to. And actually, I mean, we're talking about it's 15 years on now, right? One of the biggest fights we had was with the Bentuzzi.
Oh, don't even get me started.
Because we, well, not we. I can't even take any credit for it. But Martin and Aaron,
He said no spoilers, and that was mine. And Aaron did a lot of the background material, the story stuff. Yeah. Is basically my fault.
I'm not going to spoil it. But the point is that you did something very, very strong with the Bentuzzi. Like you made them. Mm-hmm. Really deep as characters in a game where you can't see anybody's faces. You guys really bumped up the game of you know, the ships you're interacting with and who's behind them. And that was a bit of a fight because the Bentuzzi were, you know, kind of a high profile non-player character in the first one, and were obviously, you know, they wanted them back in the second. So when you see stuff like on the first in Cataclysm, like, you know, the story and focusing so hard on the mothership and all that, that was just to drive home that don't be confused. This has got nothing to do with Homeworld and its mothership and all, you know, and their kiths. And
But I love the progression that you put into it, right? So you start out as basically a big dump truck, right? Yeah. Half of it gets broken off and you look like a bone chicken. Right. When you're in mission three or whatever it is. And by the end of the game, you're the freaking battleship Yamato. Right.
Right.
I mean, it's awesome.
And that was cool about what they did. When I came in to Cataclysm, they had already worked out that they wanted the skeleton progression. Right. Which was a stunningly cool idea.
It was a very cool idea.
Yeah. And then there was a meeting and the meeting was, hey, you cannot have Sajet. You cannot have the motherships. You cannot have the planet. You cannot have anything that affects the future of the universe, right? It's like, okay. So when you're a writer, you either freak out about stuff like that, right?
Right.
Or you go, hey, it's super deluxe challenge time, right? And that's basically what we did, right?
You came up with the RTS equivalent of, fine, we'll make our own homeworld mothership with blackjack and hookers.
Well, no, you guys, actually, Tomas, you guys, the guys at Bargain Dog had come up with the mining ship on their own, right? I just took that stuff and ran with it as far as the story went.
There we go.
Yeah.
I didn't notice this before, but Jesus fuck. Sorry, the game just did some crazy sound thing on me. I don't know what the hell that was.
You know, Brian, I think you're supposed to build spaceships to defend yourself and not just let them.
I did build spaceships to defend myself, and then I ran out of money, and I couldn't. They slaughtered me. It was great to watch.
You know, that's one thing.
I was going to say real quick. Sorry, Jim.
Okay.
That I liked how you build these sections on the ship, like the hangar module. And but I didn't know they could shoot them off individually, which is just as great.
Oh God, there's a great testing story about that with the Sierra testing department. So is it a spoiler to say what the biggest, coolest thing you can add onto the mothership is?
Go ahead.
So that's where it goes. So there's an Uber cannon that you can play. Speaking of space cruiser, and that's where it was kind of inspired from. You can put an anime giant cannon on that mining ship.
I like the sound of that.
Yes, it's fabulous, and it has an area effect, and it's just awesome. Late in the project, Sierra Testing starts haranguing us that it's too powerful, that it's an automatic game winner in multiplayer. Now, the analogous B-ship power is also pretty awesome. And both of those were kind of, as far as the tweaking of them goes, were kind of my babies by then. So I was just like, that's interesting. I hadn't noticed a problem. But we'll see. So we played a lot internally, and they're pretty balanced and a lot of win-loss and stuff. And Sierra Testing just will not let it go, right? Like, it's not, like, it's too easy. And I'm just like, and I spend 2 weeks. I pour over construction time to build the module, the tech path to get it, the amount of resources it takes to build it, how long it takes between firings, right? And I'm just like, I'm not getting this too easy. I'm not getting the auto win feeling from it. On the other hand, it was my first project as a full designer, so I'm kind of insecure, right? So it's just like, okay, because now the conversation would have been much shorter. But so it's like, okay, fine. So all I can think of is I need to see what you guys are doing, right? Like, have you found some secret gimmick that makes it easy? Because for me, I'm playing, it takes me about half an hour to get the ship up to that. Resourcing, fending off the enemy, right? Getting the cash flow coming in, building the module, right? So it's like, okay, I can't do it much quicker than half an hour sometimes, maybe 20 minutes if I'm not being hassled much. So let's play and find out. So we play full multiplayer, the biggest map we've got, 8 players. All 7 testers on their side take the mining ships. I take the beast, right? Because I think I'm playing 1-1. Then they all appear in the game. I'm like, okay, well, that's interesting, right? And within seconds, it becomes very clear that they're allied up because they don't realize that I can. I've played the game enough to know that when people can see each other's sensors, right? Because I deliberately nudge one guy and all the other fighters I can see for 2 other teams veer that way. I know they can see it, right? Like someone saying something. So they're all allied up. So that's interesting. Then I realize that I'm not harvesting yet because it's like 2 minutes into the game, but I've got cash coming in. So they've set it to a resource injection every 30 seconds. So there's no need. And then once I look at that and I look at my ship controls, I see that I'm packing everything just in time to yoink that ship off the plane and straight up because 5 big gun cannon shots converge on my starting position. Right. So in testing, they start with no resourcing, no need to resource, injections every 30 seconds of a whack ton and all the modules built on top of their ships. Right. So they start this game firing the big guns. Right? I'm just like, that was kind of my response. Hadn't thought of that, but I don't think that's a standard starting position.
Yeah, it's like starting Total Annihilation with the Krogoth already out. It's like, wait.
Yeah, what? Exactly. What? Not only that, but they know I'm player 8, so they knew where I was sitting, right, on the map, right, without seeing me yet. So, okay. So I careen out of there. This fight goes on for nearly 3 hours.
Holy right? shit.
3 hours, I kill 4 of them with the Beast Mothership. Finally, the last 3 of them pin me down in a corner and just converge and kill one of their own getting the point blank shot off, right? So, like 3 hours, everybody involved must be dripping sweat. It was massive. It was like everybody in our office is staring over my shoulder, right? Right. What's the first response from the testing team? See?
Oh, God.
I crap you not. That was the first response, the first thing typed.
So they were balance testing with no resourcing.
No resourcing and no development.
So did you correct their behavior, perhaps, upside the head? Or?
Yeah, I just
the C-cannon's still in the game, so something happened.
Yeah, well, I just mean the testing ethic of, yeah, we're going to not test the resource part of the game or any of that. We're just going to shoot the guns at each other.
Our producer at the time, Mike Yuri, wrote a very nice Canadian note to the Astaire producer and CC'd in the testing department asking please to test the game as it was designed to be played. Yes. And also to please take into account that game would indicate that the Beast ship does okay on her own.
That's pretty awesome.
Yep. Pretend you're a consumer. Start at the beginning.
Right. What we do now, instead of actually hiring testers, is we just put it out early access and let the consumer test it anyway, and then we listen.
Yeah.
We weigh their tears and.
But a lot of it, I mean, with the lean towards competitive RTS, right? They don't give you that capability. That capability to turn off resourcing or to know the changeability, right? The modability built into the game just isn't there anymore.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's the catch-22 of you make a game and your publishers always say, give the fans what they want. The players want multiple, they want options. They want to be able to dig around with it. And then they come back with you confused as to why, when you give them the keys to the kingdom and they unlock all the doors and windows and, start running away with all the gold and princesses, that, it doesn't feel like the game's running right. Well, no, because the game was balanced in a particular way. And when you let people start turning off bits and turning on and off bits and pieces, yeah, you're going to get some bad behavior out of it.
So whatever, they actually weren't wrong to test it at least once at that direction. They were just wrong that you couldn't beat it, right? Like, they were still wrong, no matter even with those settings, right? That's what I was annoyed by. Right?
Given the current climate of the MOBA games being so dominant, right, and that, do you think there's a space for a game like this that was built for esports? Or is it just kind of too slow?
Yeah, I mean, it's got a build arc, but I mean, the wildest things make it into the esports category, right? And that the esports thing is very much a fashion statement, right? Like, there are games that don't make it that for all, if you cut them apart on the table, they had all the attributes to be popular, and they just not, right? So I don't think you can pick it out. I mean, I think because an average Homeworld multiplayer game is about 45 minutes, right? What's the average going rate of a Warcraft 3 game these days?
Like Dota or whatever? It's like 20 minutes, half an hour.
Yeah, 20 minutes, half an hour, right.
Unless you get somebody thinking, cheeses and they go for like 3 hours. So, yeah.
But they're still playing some pure RTS for sports, aren't they?
Yeah.
Or is it? Yeah,
StarCraft. So.
StarCraft 2 is big. Yeah.
Yeah. So what's the average game time for a StarCraft 2 game? Like half an hour?
Yeah, right? Something like 20 that.
Minutes? Yeah. 20 minutes, half an hour is what I've noticed. So it's a bit long there, right? Like you said, if the game catches on.
Yeah. They just had some controversy in that market I was reading about the other day where some guy cheesed a StarCraft 2 match for like 3.5 hours, just wouldn't let the guy kill him, and then they ended up disqualifying him and like kicking him out of the league. So don't do that.
Yeah, exactly right. It's like the guy in chess who won't accept will topple his king, right? It's like, dude, no one's impressed watching you run around for 8 hours.
So
I wonder if that's a red herring though for RTSs, right? Because I've seen some of the more recent ones, not necessarily the space based ones, right? But you're talking about things like Planetary Annihilation or Grey Goo. They're leaning hard into the esports thing. Planetary Annihilation, in my opinion, to the detriment of single player capabilities.
Agreed.
Right?
100%, 100,000% agreed.
Yeah, I think
it didn't review well at all either, and that's kind of the unfortunate thing.
Because it was tough to play unless you were one of the alpha backers and you've been invested in that game, right? I mean, they in my opinion, they leaned into the esports really hard. And everybody else who wasn't at that level or willing to go to that level, right, was kind of left in the dust. And I know with some of their more recent updates, they're doing, a little better with the UI and things like that. But I think that might be a little bit of a red herring. It's kind of like, are you going down the MOBA path? Are you going down the free to play path? Are you going down the esports path?
Yeah.
I mean, the old man in me after 20 years in this business kind of starts to group stuff together, under the Tales to Chase banner, right? So I don't see chasing esports as being much better or much more a solid plan than chasing the quote unquote casual Sims player, right? Or as you say, chasing the free to play thing or chasing, You know, these things are all, none of them has ever resulted in the bank on it and it's a sure bet. Right? I've seen these things come and go a bazillion times, right? And it's just.
So what was going on in the market? Just talking about, you know, like our time in the industry and our long range perspective here. What year did Cataclysm come out?
2001.
So what all was going on in the market then, as far as other RTS games? Because we had StarCraft and like Crush, Kill, and Destroy and that stuff, right? It was fairly fresh.
Yeah.
That was the PlayStation dominated. Like that was the PlayStation was king at that time.
Yeah, but well, yeah, I mean in RTSs in the market.
Yeah, he's talking about RTSs, right?
Specifically. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
A lot games less worthy than Cataclysm and Homeworld got famous.
Well, that's kind of the comparison I'm trying to look at is like what Command, was the status quo versus what we're seeing here.
Yeah, the status quo was set. Command and Conquer and Warcraft, right? Or Zugzug, right? So had we hit Zugzug 2 yet? No.
No.
By that period of time. We were close, though.
2000 was Battle Isle, Earth 2150, Europa, Ground Control.
Yay, Ground Control.
Ground Control, yeah.
Yeah, Ground Control was interesting. Not particularly great, but it was interesting.
Nice.
Yeah, it was awesome. Shut up, you.
I really liked both Ground Control games and Sacrifice as well.
I didn't do the second one, so I don't care. No, I worked in Sweden for like almost a month on that game, so those were great guys.
Huh. That was also Sierra, wasn't it?
Yep. Yeah, that's why they sent me over there because I'd done Homeworld and then they sent me over to Sweden to do some story work on the first Ground Control game.
Mm. Well, I guess what I was getting at is just the stuff that this game does, and not just the fact that it's a full on 3D RTS, which I think actually probably hurt the game a little bit in the 3D-ness, people were like, oh god.
That's the thing I have to make, like, the fans who come to our boards for SOTS and stuff. Because in SOTS, I went with the game runs in 3D, but combat is done in 2D sort of thing, right? So you move your spaceships in 2D. They're free to move off the plane if they feel like it, if they need to avoid. But you're not setting altitudes or anything like that. To which a lot of the people who love to work on Cataclysm are like, pourquoi? You know, what are you doing? Because they're French. and I have to sadly explain to him that third dimension has a massive price in gameplay exposure, right? That people rejected, you know, Homeworld, that was it, right? Getting people to be able to deal with going up and down was a massive, massive issue.
Well, and it's the whole thing of, where I have trouble in the game, right? Is whenever I'm pointing at something, but then I rotate the screen to do the altitude, and then I find out, oh, I'm like clear across the galaxy from where I thought that thing was pointed.
Yep.
Right. So it's kind of it's a maneuver thing where you have to, you know, you click and then move the mouse to rotate the plane, and then you see where it really is. So that kind of takes a little finesse to get around.
It does, and it's a learning curve, and not a technical one, but a skill one. Right? Mm-hmm. Like it takes time to burn. It's like learning how to mouse look the first time in a shooter, right?
Right.
Just five
well,
or six
it's
times
like we had
that.
The guy that's making Void Destroyer had come on the show, and I like his game. It's pretty cool. But it's you know, as far as like trying to encourage him, like, dude, you have to put altitude poles in, or I can't tell, you know, where anything is. And he finally implemented some ring stuff and that. So it's kind of, it's enough, but you know, it's not really ideal for me.
I was confident moving combat to a 2D plane for Sword of the Stars, because I had seen people play Cataclysm and Homeworld a million times. And I noticed that 85% of the people who played it would go up or down in order to get to the same level as their enemy and then go at it on the same plane. Right, like they would just they fumbled around trying to get to the right altitude, and then they would just duke it out. nose to nose sort of thing.
Yeah, and I wonder if you have a player that only thinks in two dimensions like Khan versus the Kirk player that's using all three. Is the three dimension guy gonna actually have a significant advantage over the 2D guy?
Yeah, a fair amount in times, especially depending how the map works, right? So, like, for instance, that testing game, right? The only reason why I survived in 30 seconds is because I just left, right? Like, they were bracketing the shots, and I just went straight up, right? Just got the F out of Dodge. And they still weren't used to that, right? So it is useful, and it is, like I said, everybody then thinks, like, I'm down on 3D. It's like, no, I think it's awesome. But for the life of me, I cannot think of an easy way to do it.
And yeah, there really still isn't one. That's why so few games do it. Even very tactical starship control games like Starfleet Command, they kind of fudged 3D a bit. Like, oh, I went over the other ship. I didn't rent and do it. Yes.
Yeah. Well,
that's the asteroid.
Yeah, that's what SOTS do, right? If two cruisers are heading for each other, one will dive, the other will climb, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's just it. And yes, it would be a small percentage of a user base would be awesome at going up and down. Is that worth alienating a larger user base who will have trouble with it forever? That's the question you ask yourself.
Yeah. So other thing that I was thinking about in this too, like different thing that this game does versus other RTSs of the time, right, is you do have some micro in here where, you know, like you select the fighters and you have to manually fire the missiles off of them. They don't seem to do it on their own, right? You have to go trigger it, unless I'm wrong, maybe.
I can't remember, but they, like I said, there's a story about those missiles. But
yeah. Well, it's like if this was made by, say, Blizzard, then every unit would have something that you have to click on the unit like individually and trigger their power or whatever. They just built like so much micro into their game. And that's how you end up with Dota, right? Because then you end up with so much micro crap going on, you can only really control one guy.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, so with this though, it's a lot of build order, of course, but I don't find it super critical like in StarCraft, right? Because StarCraft, if you don't follow the secret recipe, you're dead.
And, right, which I think is a weakness.
Yeah, I think that's a terrible problem with those games because everybody gets their one thing that they do, and then they spend the first 10 minutes of the game cranking out exactly what they do every game, right?
Right, which is why the first moment I had my druthers, I made a game with a random tech tree. Right?
Yeah.
so that there would never be a perfect answer.
Right? Oh, God, here it comes. He's firing out Treasure Planet. So, but anyway, yeah, so it's a thing for me of just like observing, you know, what does the enemy have, and you're not necessarily trapped into a rock paper scissors with it either.
No.
You know, so it allows me to have multiple viable strategies, and I can be a little bit fluid about that. And it's just I find that a lot more satisfying even today with what's on the market versus the stuff that was in the market back then, which was incredibly primitive compared to what you guys made. Maybe it was ahead of its time, but not just the 3D thing, but it was just people weren't equipped to handle, you know, something that was not Command and Conquer.
I think it's still going to be a problem, right? We live in a day and age where EA just came out like what, 3 weeks ago, saying the problem was that EA games were too complicated. So that's an interesting sign of the times.
Well, I guess that's because where they look at the demographic, right? Because you're trying to, it's no longer now that, well, computer games and we have X number of people. Now we look at, well, there's computer games plus, you know, everybody's mom that plays Bejeweled and whatever, and we have to get all those people or the stockholders aren't happy. So
yes, exactly, right. Whereas there's more strat game players than there ever was before in the history of gaming, but because they're still the smaller percentage of the greater whole, it's a failure. It's like, I hope the powers that be that are handling this Homeworld comeback are wiser than that. The truth be told, and this also shocks people, that for all its critical acclaim, Homeworld and Cataclysm didn't make money hand over fist or anything, right? They were running the fine edge of eclectic. Right.
That's true.
And But if that had been the only consideration, then those games never would have gotten made, and we wouldn't be having this conversation. And
well, yeah, you know, and that's the thing that I look at, because I'm involved in a production right now, and it's just the deal of like, we made a thing, we want to break even and pay everybody's salary, and if we did that, then it's, you know, we did it, right? Like, we paid our salaries for the time, and that we didn't get independently wealthy or anything. And there, you know, there's no stockholders to appease, thank God. But it's like the target is just like sell enough of the game that making the game paid for itself.
Yep.
And then make another game. So, but I don't know where the industry lost that vision, and now everything has to be a super blockbuster or don't bother.
It was always there. Right. We, our producer on Cataclysm, demanded that we have a mode where the game basically played by itself.
What?
Because that's what would make sim people play it. Right.
Do you remember what he called the average Joe that he wanted this for?
Joe Average? No.
Joe Six Pack and Joe Bag of Donuts.
Yeah.
Oh, he was a Republican, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, be that as it may, I mean, his other favorite slogan is, I want this game so simple and straightforward that your dad will play it. And I'm just like, my dad's a veteran of World War II from Eastern Europe. His desire to fight spaceships is not very large. He's never going to play this game. Trust me, right?
I want to be able to... Sorry, go ahead.
And he's my dad, right? I'm just going to go on a limb and go, there's a lot of dads out there who are not interested in fighting spaceships.
Which is disappointing.
My mom said
right,
she played because... it, but I don't think she did.
The industry has always been crazy about what's the magic trick that will make everybody and their dog buy a specific game.
Yeah.
Right? It's always been crazy. I've sat in a room and been told by an executive that the reason why Diablo sold a gazillion copies is because you could left click with it.
What?
That was it. That was the key to all things Diablo, is that you could left click.
What?
Yeah. More ironically, the man who told me that had been in charge of Daikatana.
Oh, no.
Yes, and for some reason was still an executive. Explaining to me how Diablo works.
Did this guy have like really long hair?
Nope.
Oh, it's not that guy. Nope. Okay.
That's okay. This was a producer dude, right?
All right.
Point is, and that was a bazillion years ago. So the industry has always been rife with that.
Yeah, you know, the thing whenever I would do game reviews, right? And my mother, while she played some 2600 stuff, and I was so proud she rolled Asteroids over one night. But she was not at all the hardcore gamer. So if I was playing something that I could at all get her in front of the computer, right, it was like, okay, sit down and tell me if you can figure this interface out. And and if she could figure it out, then it was like, okay, well, you know, the job is done here. But, you know, and maybe that's the market today, right, is like if you can put your mom in front of it and she's cool – then.
Well, no, don't confuse the difference though between accessibility and
subject
trying
matter.
To find and trying to find this magic bullet of win.
Yeah.
Because I mean, we do the same thing, right? Like there's nobody should want to make a game that, you know, people can't figure out how to play, right?
And I, honest to God, I'm not going to want to play a game that is the target market is everybody. Right, it's like you got to come in my wheelhouse, or I don't really want to see it. So,
well, what was the last version of The Sims you played?
The first one,
never. Yeah. But I own them all because you know,
life exactly.
Happens. But
but that's a case in general, right? So that's kind of how it should be, right?
Yeah.
Lots of people should love to play The Sims. Lots of people shouldn't, right? Where it gets strange is everything must just be like that, like,
right? Well, and there's another thing too about that, because, you know, speaking of The Sims, and my wife does, man, she's hardcore on that stuff, and she plays the casual games on her iPad and does all that stuff. However, she is the first person to get super pissed whenever people talk about girl games, because she is the worst camper in Call of Duty ever. I mean, she played it competitively, right? She was on the league,
yep.
and And it's just that whole deal of like, oh yeah, girl games, whatever. And it's like, no, the girls have access to more games than us because they play our shit and they go over and
yeah. Well, you remember bringing up the column I had, right? What's the deal with? One column I wrote, which was the most viciously run over, was I did one calling BS on the whole girl game thing way back when, because I thought it was a dubious idea back then. So basically, I wrote some my basic premise was, they're just gamers. We're gamers. They're gamers. We're all just fucking gamers. Make some games. People will play them, right? Don't market it to people's sexual organs because it's a bad idea. To which I thought I was going to get two forms of responses. One was, yay, that's right, you're awesome. And B, no, bitches can't play, right? That's what I was expecting, right? To which I got those two responses, which I was expected. Then I got letters from women telling me, some letters, not all, right? But some letters from women telling me that I was the most horrible man on the face of the earth for saying that they would want to get dirty and shoot things. And I was just like, huh, that's interesting, right? And then there was the weird gamers gate guys, proto gamers gate guys who are like, you only wrote that so girls will be friendly to you, right? And that was the fourth faction.
You're only in it to get the chicks, right? Because honestly, whenever I was writing game reviews, I was just rolling in chicks, man.
Chick
was,
magnet.
Oh, my God. Because I'm at the bar, and they're like, what do you do? I'm like, I review Vigima games. Yep. And they were like, oh. Yep. It was like panty
remover. The amount of E3s I've been to where I have stand up on the bar, hold my hand up in the air, and go, lady, Mary, pointing at my ring finger. Dozens of times in my imagination.
I got that chick a cheat code. Chicks love cheat codes.
But this big thing where we want to, like, people are just driven to categorize, like I said, games as a girl game. So like, if a dude plays, what was that, Animal Town or whatever? What was the cute Nintendo game where you...
Animal Crossing.
So if I play, like, Animal Crossing, you know, maniacally for 2 months, that means what? I don't get to reproduce or something?
It means you played Animal Crossing maniacally for 2 months.
Animal Crossing is a grim game about human slavery. So I think, you know, that Tom Nook's a bastard. By the way, my wife yelled from the other room, I'm not a camper, so, you know.
You know what? That's exactly what a camper would say.
That's right. It must be funnier that when you walk back out through the door, she'll be waiting there and hitting you with a tire iron.
Now, I did want to talk about Treasure Planet a little bit because, like, I did not know you guys worked on this until Paul told me.
And
I've actually owned a copy for years, but I've only played, like, the skirmish a little bit because I never saw the movie. Yeah. It was just it's a spaceship game. I have to own it, so I'm going to own it. But I didn't want to play it until I saw the movie. So then I saw the movie, which was all right.
I love that movie. Don't be mean to it.
I'm not being mean. The story was okay. The visuals were astounding. And and the design, like the ships and everything, marvelous.
Yeah.
Story was okay.
we loaded one of those ships into our machines at Barking Dog and it broke the machine.
No.
So I would like the Cataclysm mod where you guys bring these ships in.
Now, how did this come about? How did Treasure Planet come about?
Treasure Planet did come about on the strength of Cataclysm. We got some good critical review on that. We were touring the team around. Oddly enough, I had known in my reporter days, I had known a couple of the guys who were in the Disney offices up here, Disney Interactive up in Victoria. So there's a bit of connection there. And they were looking for proposals for a game. And Disney at the time was very interested in, because that movie also, to give a little Disney background, Disney was in the middle of a faction war at the time.
What?
There was a faction at Disney that saw the oncoming anime wave and wanted to get in front of it. So wanted to evolve some Disney titles from the 4 to 10 year old market to the 8 to 14 year old market, right? They wanted some of that Robotech action,
which was not a bad idea. They were being viciously fought by the old guard who wanted to keep it 4 to 10 year olds, 3 animal sidekicks per movie, right? X hundred $1 million for sure for toys from that. Deal with it. Atlantis was the first of the young adult movies that they put out, and it did okay. Treasure Planet was the second. So when they were looking for a game, it was the same thing. Part of them were just looking for the Happy Meal game stuff, really quick, just kids bang head on keyboard. You know, robot pops up and goes, oh, and yay, you're done. And then there was a faction who was like, we want you to make Bobby's first RTS, right? We want the first budding, because RTSs were big, you know, super big at the time, right?
Sure.
So we want the brand, Disney Interactive wants the brand loyalty of the kid who sits down to play his first bandbox, click, and blow something up game. But don't blow stuff up too graphically because they're little kids. And it's like, and we also need someone who can work inside a franchise. And we were able to say, dude, we just wrote an entire game inside someone else's universe and left it clean when we were done. So we're your people. Because Cataclysm, go ahead.
No, I see this as Baby's first Starfleet Command is how I see this. This is much more akin to that kind of tactical starship combat than a more traditional RTS, I think, which I love about
it. I might have lied a bit. You know, give me a break.
You know, I'm getting a little Rebel Galaxy twitch from this too, because of the broadsides and the pirate ships and the Diablo before too, right? And that's those guys.
At the time, they weren't quite sure what they want, and I kind of argued them away from the resourcing and building buildings thing, just because that's a lot of intellectual overhead for a kid, right?
Yeah.
And instead, I'm like, you know what? The introduction really needs to be, like I said, grabbing stuff, giving orders, clicking, watching things move around, making the ships be very alive so their rudders turn and stuff like that. Right? And they're kind of excited about that, and they liked the storyline we pitched them, which was, again, very self-contained.
Right.
Because at the time, they were thinking the movie would do huge, and it would have a cartoon show and stuff like that. So they didn't want us wrecking anything, right?
I would have watched that show.
I so would have watched that show. Also, it was funny, the entire enemy race in that game comes out of a single line, because they shipped us down to watch the movie when it still wasn't finished yet. So you've watched movies like that where the movie suddenly just shows a piece of art and the dialogue being spoken over it.
It was a very rough work print. There were like napkin sketches in there somewhere. Yeah.
So in that print, the Cat Admiral lady makes one reference to the Procyons, right? Fighting them. And I'm just like, in my notebook to this day, there is like the word Procyon ? 3 lines underneath it. Because in my pitch, it was like, you have a lot of pirate stuff and you love it and it's yours. We can whip you up these Procyon guys out of whole cloth and you can ignore them if you want afterwards. And they're like, yeah, perfect.
So in the pitch, like, what was the age demographic for the kids? Not only for the game, but the movie as well. Because I would assume they'd align.
Yeah, it was 8 to 14, right? That's what we were tasked with. Our secondary task was your dad should be able to teach you how to play this game without losing his goddamn mind through boredom, right? So the nuance layer was, it was supposed to be a son and dad game because it was Disney. They're very into that typical thing. And it was supposed to be grown-up can play it with child without clawing their own eyes out from boredom sort of thing. So we were allowed to nuance stuff a bit to go, yes, it's fun. You can click and point and bang. Torpedoes have a turning radius. So that a grown-up can use that and turn inside them, that sort of thing.
Well, I kind of appreciate that it's got some depth to it, you know, because it's like if you're going to get a kid to play a game, you might as well teach them a little Starfleet battles while you're at it, right? Under the guise of
Starfleet battles. Like I said, and my other task was to make sure that the parent playing with it was enjoying themselves too, right? Like there had to be something that could engage, and even an older kid, right? Like playing with your older brother or sister, that sort of thing. Because it was meant to be the start of a whole line of things for Disney, right? Disney was going to do a lot of these age group games, right? So it's like, okay, you're going to do this, then our task is to make a game that will grow with a kid a bit, right? And so we tried really hard to do that. The sad thing was we were, I think, 2 months away from finishing it, and the movie was 3 months away. And suddenly, because I've done some Hollywood work in the past, so I kind of knew the business, I noticed that no emails were coming from Disney that had people's names at the bottom and the name Treasure Planet in the same email. And I got a really bad feeling about that. Right?
Were they just abandoning their own movie? Like,
what I found out a little while later is that the coup had failed. All the guys worried about the anime market were fired. Right?
Oh.
The movies went back to the standard pattern, and Treasure Planet was abandoned before it even was released. Right.
So
it was dead. Yeah. Well, imagine working with a relatively young team who are really excited about doing a game that they can be proud of for a movie, which is rare enough, right? To be proud of a movie game, and that it's going to get this huge backing from the studio and all this stuff we were promised, and having to go out every morning and looking at them and not saying no, right? I have a feeling this is going to go badly, right?
So as far as the movie went, did Disney give it the John Carter treatment where they just forgot that it existed?
Yep. That's exactly what they advertised it for exactly a week, and that was it. And it disappeared into the ether, so to speak.
It's a damn shame because it really had potential, but it did feel like they were trying to court two different masters with that movie.
Yeah, they're trying something new, right? Like, it's not perfect, but it was an evolution, right?
Right.
It was an attempt to start serving. So you can say the same thing of Atlantis, right? Like, Atlantis is an uneven little movie too, but there's some moments of really, you know, startling maturity, right, for a Disney movie, right?
Yeah. It's something that Disney didn't sort out until Pixar got absorbed into them.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking if you guys, Disney still owns the IP, right? So it's not like you're going to get it from them. But a game that's similar to this, though, you know, just in everything,
I've always wanted,
and then put it on tablets, right? Because that's where kids are.
Yeah. Actually, there was a game, Plundernauts, I looked at about 6 months ago, which was a pirate ship. It was very similar, a bit more cartoony, not as satisfying, like tactically or anything like that. But, people do it every once in a while, and every once in a while I have a desire to, because I like that form of, you don't see point balancing a lot anymore either. Like, for instance, World of Tanks is a tier balanced game, right? Four light tanks, four medium tanks, four heavy tanks. You wait around for the game to start, because that's a way less risky thing to balance. But Treasure Planet works on a point basis, so we set the points for a multiplayer fight at 200 points, which means you could come in, you could choose two dreadnoughts, and I could choose eight torpedo boats, right? Two cruisers. It's balanced out that way, which, like I said, you don't see as much these days. So it would be fun to bring a game like that back.
And this game looks great. This could definitely, this could easily be on GOG. You know, it installed just fine on Windows 7 here. It didn't have any issues at all.
I think it's not because no one knows who. I mean, technically Disney owns it, but Disney doesn't even know it exists. So
yeah. Every once in a while, for the last few years, I get two types of emails. One was Cataclysm ? And the other one was Treasure Planet ?
Yep.
And unfortunately, we got nothing. It's, nothing to do with us, unfortunately.
Yeah, I bet if you put it on Good Old Games, then Disney'd suddenly remember that it exists.
Oh, yeah. Disney lawyers would find us in seconds, and there'd be a cruise missile strike, and that'd be it.
No, it'd have to be Disney themselves that would put it on.
Yes, definitely. And they just got they have no interest in doing anything that's not going to pull in, X gazillion dollars.
What about a Captain EO game?
I would hope that they would see, the reception LucasArts has been getting on GOG and see, hey, maybe, because people, they're, leaving money on the table, really, because people will buy this stuff.
Right, but I mean, they left the money on the table at the original release of that game.
That's true. I couldn't even find a patch for it. It was like it was released and then poof. You know, like there was no – it didn't seem like there was even any – like Cataclysm had a patch. You actually have to install it to get it to run on Windows 7. But with this one, there's nothing. There's no patch. Like people don't even remember this one.
Yeah. Both those games are really important about forming our checklist of things we wanted to do when we went and made our own company sort of thing. Mm. Control of patching was one of them, right? Because, for instance, Cataclysm got one patch, and that was it, right? Sierra ran it through testing and would not okay another one, right? Which was disappointing. So,
it's very disappointing because this is not a bad game.
Nope.
And well, that was the thing that you guys told me when I came out and visited was it was actually used as a test for game reviewers to come in and say, you know, sit down with this game for 3 hours and then write a review for it. And they knew if they actually wrote a game that said, this ain't half bad, right, then that would be somebody who actually plays games and understands games versus, oh, this is just a tie-in, you know, just another attempt to cash in, blah, blah, blah.
Well, it's one of the few movie license games, especially of that era, that I can think of that's worth a damn.
Yeah. Oh, it's actually worth a damn? Yeah, exactly. Like this and maybe that Riddick game are like the really only good movie tie-in games I can really think of.
No, my daughters were like 6 and 8, and they were the testing core for that game.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. No, and the Sega, again, not spoilers, but my proudest moment in any of the game projects or game writing I've done, any of the game dramatic scripts I've written, is having my 6-year-old daughter look up from the screen at me and goes, "There's something wrong with John Silver. He would never say something like that. I'm suspicious."
I actually won a bet with this game once because someone was like, "I bet you $5 that I own a more obscure game than you do." And then they pulled out like they pulled out like Warwind or something, which I actually do own. I'm like, "I got you one better." And then I pulled this out and they're like, "What the fuck is that? Okay, here."
That's heartening and makes me sad at the same time.
I'm sorry. I just thought it was a good story. You know, I thought it was a good story.
Yeah.
Well, if there's anything we can walk away with from Treasure Planet, it's that we're proud that we managed to get Suicide Units into a Disney property without them noticing.
Suicide Units? Really?
Yeah, which was that, too?
They blew themselves up, remember?
What?
In the story?
Spoiler. Yeah, the Ironclads. Yeah.
They didn't want you to find out who was behind the Ironclad. So in the middle of the narrative, they destroy themselves.
Okay, guys, we're talking about 10-year-old games, relatively obscure games, right? I'm just gonna release the spoilers right now. There is no battle at Procyon in this game.
That's right. Oh god, that was great. Another great big publisher. Have you seen the credits at the end? Have you gone that far?
I don't remember. We got
our revenge at the end credits. Because at the end credits, there's an asterisk under the name Battle at Procyon. And it says, but the bottom asterisk is, "Note, battle may not actually take place at Procyon."
Disney actually contacted us and said, "You got to take that out." And we're like, "No." "No." "Does the game take place at Procyon? Then you may want us to leave it in." "Okay, thanks, bye."
That's like, awesome.
So the whole title is a misdirect. It's a lie.
Well, like I said, like they announced that title again very close to the end. I'm just like, I'm on the phone. It's like, you do realize that the entire hook of the story is finding out that the Procyons are responsible, right?
Yeah.
I don't, and literally the response from there was, "I don't think that's important." Which was my second favorite Disney thing happening on that project, next to Regina. It was my favorite.
Wow.
Next to what?
You want the Regina story really quick?
Sure.
That sounds fun.
That's right. Well, yeah, I guess. So we're Canadians, and we live in a country that speaks the King's English, or the Queen's English. And we actually have a city called Regina, because that's how it was pronounced. and they very much wanted me to write in the vernacular of the original book, right? So I had to spend a bit of time like reshaping it to, you know, Victorian adventure or close to Edwardian, I guess. But anyways, that sort of stuff, right? And the names of the star bases and naval bases are all very English Empire-y and stuff like that. And I guess to us, not for our people, there's a reference to Starbase Regina, to which recording was a bit odd because Disney, because of a scheduling conflict, I couldn't go down. I didn't have the time to go down and direct the voice talent. But Disney still wanted me in on it, so I basically did it through a conference call, right? They just had the speakerphone on in the studio and was listening to the actors and giving them some direction, stuff like that. So we get to that line, and the woman says it. And she goes, oh, how am I supposed to pronounce it? I'm like, without even thinking, I'm like, it's Starbase Regina, right? And the guy, the Disney guy handling the board there goes, no, it isn't. I'm like, yeah, it is.
Oh, no.
He's like, no, it isn't. And he says, I'm going to check.
Yeah.
And he gets up and you hear, ree, his seat being pushed back. And they hear, thump, 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 thump. Ree, door opening. Ree, 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 ree. Knock, knock, knock in the distance. Click, thump, 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 thump. Click, thump into a seat. It's Regina. Like, okay.
I was going to mention to you, Martin, now that you brought it up, I was listening to a podcast with a film director who filmed in Regina, and he was complaining. He's like, I get up there, and I kept pronouncing it Regina. And they're like, no, it's Regina, eh? He's like, no, that's terrible. Why do you do it that way? It's our country, eh? What do you want?
Really?
Yeah. So
let's come a little forward now and talk about Kerberos. I said that right? Right?
Kerberos. Yep, Kerberos. Well done.
Kerberos. Yep. So you guys did Swords of the Stars, yada, yada. You guys have the Pit and Ground Pounders, which are awesome. Yep. I love both of them, by the way. What's going on with the Kaiju game?
Almost done.
Almost done.
Really?
Almost
really? Done. Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It's actually happening? Oh, my God. 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 Oh, my God.
It's a bit over a month away.
So I just shot
a helicopter out of the sky with an I-beam yesterday, so that was fun.
Okay. Sorry. I actually just squealed. You actually just made me squeal.
Wow. What is the name of this kaiju business?
Kaiju Agogo?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, yep. It's actually happening.
Oh, yeah.
I have to play it. I backed the Kickstarter. I think I backed the Indiegogo. I backed something. I don't remember, but I want. Oh my God! I'm so excited. I'm so because I haven't heard much about it in a while.
Yep. Well, we've been working like crazy. It's a big game. We got the Indiegogo plan became putting out one chapter at a time. So, it starts with Ginormosaurus, and then chapter two will add in Shrubby or Gordon. Armageddon, and then the third chapter will be that. We'll for people who support in on the Kickstarter, they get all that stuff for free for their initial entry fee. And on Steam, the plan is for that if you buy it initially, you'll get the other two for free as well. The game will increase in price for each chapter that's added.
Sure.
So the earlier you come in, the better off you are.
Sure.
And then after that, we'll do then the real DLCs will come out after that, which are, you know, other monsters, and then we'll do a full expansion probably called Monster Island, which will be as it sounds. We'll add the Gotta Catch 'Em All component to the game.
Whenever I first saw this, I thought it was like a. Something different than what I'm seeing right now, right? Because I'm looking on the site. So this reminds me of the unfortunately abandoned They Came From Hollywood that Sparky and Lars were working on over at Phobe, and it's unfortunate that never happened because that was like the Epic's movie monster game / Crush,
yes.
Crumble and Chomp reboot that
yes.
I wanted.
Yes.
And then I guess you're doing it. So
This is my Crush, Crumble, and Chomp reboot, which had been sitting as a two-pager proposal in our files at the office for like 10 years now, possibly.
Yeah. Right?
Chris, yeah.
It goes back a long way, yeah.
Goes back a long way. It's right up there with the post-apocalypse rebuilder game. Because when you do stuff, and especially back in the day when we were more publisher-centric than we are now, right, you do a lot of pitch documents for games you'd like to do. So Kaiju Agogo is, yeah, like I said, it comes from an older idea. But I played, when I was in university, I played Crush, Crumble, and Chomp on my buddy's TRS-80 like crazy. I've always loved that game. And while I've loved playing, like, Rampage and stuff, it's never quite scratched that itch.
Yeah, that's the game that I bought a Commodore 64 to play.
Yep. So. And all the other giant monster games are all, like, arena fighters, right? Which is strange. You know, it's like, I don't know if I want to play Ghidra just to fight Godzilla. I'd rather wipe out a city. Thanks. So yeah, we'd like most games that we do, it's because we want to play a game and no one else is making it, so we made it. So that's what Kaiju Agogo is. Kaiju Agogo is kind of, so we're all familiar with XCOM, right?
Yep.
So picture being the evil alien from XCOM, but looking at a similar interface in which you're looking at the vulnerable world spinning by and picking where you want to abuse people. So you are playing the mad scientist with the helpless world in front of you, all the cities, for various personal reasons, might have to do with your small stature, we don't know. You seek revenge on the world, and you are sending your monster out into it to attack cities, undermine their morale to the point where they surrender to you, and eventually conquer the earth through that method of intimidation and skullduggery, while improving your Kaiju robot with an array of 99 powers that you could possibly trade.
Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait. I gotta make sure what I backed it on.
Yeah. It's fun that it's, despite the vast array of things to do, when you do testing, you test stages a lot, right? So I've been testing just the start of the game, like, pretty heavily for the past 2 weeks. So just the opening, beating up the city just with my claws on my feet, right? Having to get out of dodge before I get shot up too bad by the defenses, that sort of thing. And then just a few days ago, I'm like, okay, that's good. I will now train up my first power, and I pick the I-beams. After you've been just kicking people a lot, which is fun, shooting two laser beams of death, like, halfway across the screen, which is just squealicious.
So I assume it's going to be a real-time game, right?
Yeah, combat is, yeah, it's actually all real time. You can slow down, but time is passing all the time. You're under some time pressure because after the 5-year mark, the world forces that are left will array against you and come hunting your secret base.
Okay, but I mean the in-city
combat's real stuff. Time. Yep.
Yeah. So what controls?
Mouse control to move the monster, just click and he'll go there. And then mouse click targeting for advanced weaponry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
it's
really simple, right?
Well, this game will be a success because you can left click. So
you can left click. That's it. I never forgot. The producer of Daikatana changed my life forever at that moment.
You should just call it Kaiju Diablo, and Kaiju. It'll sell a bazillion.
Oh, I'm sorry, guys. I backed the Kickstarter and not the Indiegogo. I feel bad.
That's okay. That's okay. Just buy it opening day and scream it to all your friends.
I will. I'll tell them. Yeah. Because I'm excited about this game. I'll tell them about
it. Like I said, it's pretty fun, and it's got all the classic bits, like the jets that attack you and tanks that drive up to you. Like, it's, again, it's perversely fun. So Jeeps just have a machine gun, and they're pretty fast, and they don't do much damage to you. They're pesky. Mm. But chasing one down across the street and stepping on it is still perversely fun. Right.
Oh, cool. So as the game goes on, I mean, I see, you know, tanks and helicopters and jets and stuff. Yep. Here. Does Earth, like, research, like, Power Rangers that they send after you, or?
You will see the base. The game works in a way that each continental region, there's 6 regions, because no one really lives in Antarctica. They have the cities run in from tier 1 to tier 5, with 1 being, like, small and tier 5 being, like, New York City equivalents. and the really powerful, the higher tiered the city, the more powerful defense units it has. So you can walk into New York City on your first day if you want. The odds of surviving it with your initial monster, fairly slim, but you could do it if you wanted to. As the game progresses, the cities get better defended, and each zone has its own super defender unit, which it begins to research and produce. So, I mean, I'm not saying for sure, but say, you know, zone 5, which is Asia, might produce a giant shiny robot.
That's exciting. Now, I want to ask, the KaijuGoGo.com site, it's apparently you can still pledge to the game if you want to support it. Can I do that, like, right now?
You can absolutely do that if you want. I was gonna say, and then I was kind of like, I don't. We weren't gonna rattle our tin can at you in the middle of a conversation on your show, but yes, we.
It's my show. I'm giving you $20. I don't give a shit. I'm doing it right now.
Yes, well, what tomorrow. We want. Yes.
Yeah. How much money Martin do you pointed. Need to get that I can play this right now? Can I write a check?
That doesn't seem to be an option, Sam.
No.
Oh no, yeah. we'll discuss it after the show because I will, for a super amount of money, I will zip you up a copy.
I won't even charge you to beta test this.
That's right.
Yeah.
Actually, the press copy is going out soon, so if you talk to Mr. Stewart after the interview, I'm sure we could arrange something for you.
Yeah. I'm still buying one. I still bought one anyway. I don't care. I'm supporting you guys.
Oh, I'll buy 10.
Thank you very much.
I had completely forgotten that you guys were doing this. I was actually going to ask you earlier, like, so what are you guys doing? Well, now I know.
Yep.
And I feel my wallet twitching even now. Like, as soon as I saw this thing, it was like, oh, here we go. So
yeah. Keep your wallet safe because it's going to be an interesting year. There's going to be. Now, there are other stuff in the works as well.
I was just about to ask about that. Is there anything sort of the stars related in the pipe?
The universe,
yes.
The Sword of Stars universe, yes.
Space game?
No, it's going to be a giant robot game because
that's right. It's a giant robot game.
Because I pitched to Bart, I was like, "You got to make a mecha game out of Ground Pounders, because then it'll be Ground Stompers."
That's right. Ground Pounders was designed actually to easily do that, right? If there was a call for a giant mech war game that. Wasn't riddled with holes? Yeah, we'd make it in a second.
Well, not that I'm saying the ones that exist. I'm calling you now.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. I think you actually dropped the shoe earlier in the episode. I just don't think they caught you saying it, Martin. So.
Well, I just bought KaijuGoGo off your site because I want it. Oh my god! That seems like a good place to wrap it up. We've been talking a while, guys.
Yes.
Well, wait. I do want to ask them though. Okay, so Sword of the Stars 1, love it.
Yep.
Right. Sword of the Stars 2, can't quite seem to hook it. Right. It's like Sword I want to love it. Perfect.
Yes. And if it had been given the proper care and attention during its growth phase, you would like it much better.
Yeah. But I mean, it's done now, right? Like there was some issues, you know, early on, but it's patched it up and it's a complete product.
It's a playable game. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think it's the shift from being where I would just send fleets to places to now I have to have an admiral and then build a fleet around him and you know, and it's trying to make the switch in my head between the two types of gameplay. But then again, I'm glad that you did something different because if Sword of the Stars 2 had just been like more of that. Then
right. As a designer, I will always cop to that. All right, I'm never happy to do the exact same thing again. Right, it's just not what I picked this crazy job to do. Right, so I'm always looking to evolve the form. And yeah, some things work better than others. Right, like I said, I still stand by a lot of stuff in that game, and I wish it.
Excuse me.
It had been given the continuous support it needed in development in order to maintain a staff that would have made release better. But yeah, you do what you can in a difficult world.
Right, but I mean, as far as the game stands today, though, you know, that all that stuff aside, but the way the game is today, are you satisfied with where it's at? And it's like, I just need to try harder or what? 'Cause
Because, like I said, for me, it's not that I dislike it. I just haven't clicked with it yet.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't, if it were possible to have the finances to do another 2 months of tweaking in response to people's feedback over the past couple of years, because that's one of the things we like to do, it would be good. But we're in a curious position with that franchise as far as the sales rights to it go. So,
oh, because apparently.
Yeah. Two? What? Mom, is it dinner already? What? Huh?
Sorry.
Next week on Lack of Discretion Theater, we'll be looking at.
Yeah.
Well, it's a good time to point out, because I think there are some real grumps out there that try to pin it on us that we're saying SOTS 2 is perfect. And no, as Martin said, you know, with the time and the resources, there's stuff we'd like to, you know, respond to people's feedback and improve. And I mean, the fact of the matter is, yeah, okay, actually, no, this has to be said, Martin. Martin is the George Lucas of games. He'd tweak his games forever, given half a chance. But
I would not make hand shoot ever.
Ever.
You take that back or I'm punching you tomorrow.
All right, I take it back. But no, the thing is that, you know, we're always looking at our games and what people are playing and how they're playing it and all that. And, you know, we kind of go out of our way to put quite a long tail of support on our games whenever we can. So
that's part of why we've, like I said, the lesson we learned from Cataclysm and Treasure Planet is that people kept playing the game after that first expansion, after that first update, right? It's like,
yeah,
ooh, those are good ideas. We'd like to put those in and or change that little thing or tweak that so it's clear to people. And you can't when someone else is holding the strings, right? So that's why with our full indie from the pit onwards, it's totally our control.
So I have one final question. I came across this while looking at your website. North Star?
Oh, North Star.
Is that like Fist of the North Star?
That's right. Nope, it's we do space RPG. Something near and dear to our hearts. That is a full meal deal game, so that's a full meal deal budget, which we've always been looking around for to help with that. There will be a piece of North Star news sometimes this year, I suspect, if we can something in. Right?
So we might have you back.
I hope you're back, because there's a couple other pieces of mind blowing on the way that you might appreciate.
Intriguing. I like the tease. Let's leave it on the tease. Leave them wanting more.
Yep.
So, we'll end it here. I want to thank our guests, Martin Cyrulis.
Right?
Cyrulis. God damn it.
I knew I'd screw it up a lot.
Chris Stewart and Paul Tobias. I almost said Tobias.
We'd be happy to do this again, but that Paul guy can't keep talking like this.
I know.
Because it was nonstop. And it was a little embarrassing.
Shut up, Paul. God.
Paul. Always about you.
God damn it,
you,
Paul. You. Well, folks, I want to thank you for watching. This has been a really fun podcast. Jim, thank you for being an awesome co-host. And next week, what are we doing next week? I think we're having the guy from Transcendence on, right? That's that spacey roguelike thing that just hit green light.
Nice.
So that's going to be fun. So stay tuned for that, folks. Thank you for listening and watching, and we'll see you next week.
Yeah, and if you guys just want to come back and hang out, you know, you can do that anytime.
Yeah, oh, totally.
Sure. We're easy.
Sounds good.